This message is brought to you by Nuveen. Nuveen has provided investment excellence for 125 years with expertise across income and alternatives. Nuveen continues to expand its capabilities while maintaining its legacy as a leading investment manager. Visit Nuveen.com to learn more. Investing involves risk. Loss of principal is possible.
Hey, what's news, listeners? It's Sunday, April 7th. I'm Luke Vargas.
And I'm Anne-Marie Fertoli for The Wall Street Journal. This is What's News Sunday, the show where we tackle the big questions about the biggest stories in the news. We reach out to our colleagues across the newsroom to help explain what's happening in our world.
This week, we're looking at a debate that's playing out within college sports over whether athletes are amateur students or professionals, a debate with potentially huge implications for the future of American education and for the future of sports. So take your seat. The game is about to begin. Last month, 13 of the 15 players on Dartmouth's men's basketball team voted to join the Service Employees International Union. And if college athletes sound like a surprising addition to a union better known for representing nurses, janitors, and members of law enforcement, or really any union for that matter, well, you're not wrong, because it's only in just the last few years that this could even have been imaginable. But things are changing quickly now, as the NCAA, the largest organizing body for college sports, contends with a barrage of legal attacks that are rapidly shifting the ground on which college athletics stand, away from a long-running opposition to paying athletes to more practical questions about how much those athletes should be paid and what other workplace benefits they might be entitled to. Here to unpack as much of that as we possibly can in the little time that we've got, I'm joined by Wall Street Journal reporter Louise Radnofsky. She's been closely tracking the transformation of college sports, as has Journal sports columnist Jason Gay. Louise, I want to start with you, because these Dartmouth athletes are just the latest twist in a much longer story. Tell us how we got here, if you could.
Yeah, it's a pretty busy time. There's about half a dozen antitrust lawsuits working their way through courts around the country that are taking aim at the NCAA's restrictions on athletes getting compensated in some form or other. And then there are three separate labor cases, Dartmouth being the right to form a union, a similar sort of complaint out of the other side of the country coming from USC. And then another case that is in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals about a different federal labor law.
And Louise, this isn't just coming from the athletes themselves. It's the National Labor Relations Board, right, that's given them basically an assessment that they would qualify to join a union.
Exactly. The National Labor Relations Board that is going to consider appeals is the same National Labor Relations Board whose general counsel put out a memo saying that, in her opinion, college athletes were employees, and she was all but inviting somebody to come forward and try and do this so that it could become a sort of test case. All of these lawsuits and a lot of this labor action is chasing in the wake of a very sympathetic Supreme Court that in 2021 ruled unanimously that strict limits on athlete compensation by the NCAA violates antitrust law.
All right, so Jason, we've got recent legal decisions. We've got certain groups of students unionizing, but I have to imagine this is coming from some bigger sense that something needs to change on campuses. How far does this go back?
Well, I think it goes back to the commodification of college sports as entertainment, right? The idea that you could not just go to football games, but you could put them on television, you could command top dollar for it. And, you know, that is something that has been happening for generations. But really, in the last generation, we've seen an incredible growth in terms of salaries for athletic directors, certainly coaches, many states in the country. The highest paid state employee is the football coach. If it's not the football coach, it's often the men's basketball coach. And Louise is absolutely right with regard to the Supreme Court aspect of this. The Supreme Court unanimously effectively saying this is tantamount to a cartel, what the NCAA is doing. And what's changed, I think, here is the public opinion. If I was writing about college athletes getting paid, even when I started the Journal a decade and a half ago, the reaction would have been pretty strongly opposed to the notion of it.
All right, so public opinion changing rapidly here. I want to hear from a listener on this, Carol Alperly. She called in kind of with a question about how difficult it might be to actually draw a line here on where this story goes next. Let's hear from her.
If student athletes are compensated for their time and effort, then shouldn't accompanying cheerleaders, marching bands, and pep bands be compensated as well? While news reports draw attention to money-making athletic programs, my understanding is that most athletic programs don't make a profit. Will the burden of paying student athletes be too much for these programs? Will they lack the funds to compete for talent? Might some colleges and universities have to give up athletic programs entirely?
Jason, listening to Carol there, I can almost feel the blood pressure rising for college administrators, athletic directors, wondering how far is this going to go?
These are the kinds of things that you hear specifically from schools about where does it stop? I think a good way to look at it actually is the sort of early test case of name, image, likeness, which is something that the NCAA basically threw up its hands a couple seasons ago and said, okay, everyone can do this. We're not going to try to figure out how to police it. Just go for it. And it's messy, but it hasn't driven college sports into the ground, as we were forewarned about for many, many years.
Okay, we've got to take a short break, but clearly big implications here, well beyond college campuses. But when we come back, we're going to talk about what is actually changing at universities, where the NCAA stands on all of this. We'll be right back.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
All right, Louise, Jason, we've got a lot of questions to keep getting to here. Louise, it sounds like there's a number of different models that schools could turn to here to try to figure out how to navigate some of the legal pressure that they're facing. From your reporting, it sounds like the NCAA is kind of trying to head this off, putting forward its own vision for what a sustainable model might look like. Walk us through that.
Yeah, the NCAA's idea is that the richest schools in Division I could compensate their athletes specifically for playing sports, which would be in and of itself a watershed moment for the NCAA that has maintained for a century that you cannot pay athletes to play sports. They are playing, they are not working. The NCAA is sort of leaning into that around Division I with arguments about, in part, what it might do for Division II schools and Division III schools that cannot afford to do this in the same way that the top tier of Division I schools can, and that's been a major area of concern for them. Where the NCAA is drawing its line in the sand, however, is over employee status. That is the one thing that they want to stave off more than anything else. They will concede the point on paying if they do not have to concede the point on employment. Over the next few years, we're going to see whether the courts force that employment decision on them anyway.
Jason, from what you can pick up, is there a sense the NCAA can still call the shots here?
The NCAA has shaped up a little bit in the last couple of years in terms of being more empathetic to the idea of compensating athletes. But what Louise sketched out there is effectively the NCAA's survival plan. You know, the idea that, okay, you're going to take the super class of football programs and basketball programs, and they can go off and create basically their own NCAA, their own governance, their own system for compensating or not compensating or whatever they want to do with their athletes. The NCAA will sit where they are and try to regulate what's left behind. And there's this belief that after an enormous amount of turmoil and basically eviction from the NCAA, that there will be some kind of reset in which college athletics could return to a version of Division III, you know, where we have college athletics on universities that are vital to the life of the university but aren't necessarily pursued as major capitalist enterprises. I don't know how well that'll sit with alumni necessarily, but there's this belief that once you sort of break away these super programs, well, maybe everybody else will want to decaffeinate college sports a little bit.
Let's work on another listener question here. This is from Jeff Wilson, who was sort of citing the fact that, you know, when we're talking about this Dartmouth story, we're talking about a university whose sports teams and market really are different from many of the schools, Jason, that you were just talking about there. Let's hear from Jeff.
I think about Ivy League basketball and I think, well, there's not really that much of an economic pie, so it must be something else, which maybe points to an attempt to divide the power allocation a little differently between an athletic administration and the players, which is a totally different topic from what I think we would see in big money sports, which very much will likely be about dividing an economic pie differently. So it was an odd place for me to see a unionization effort start, meaning at Dartmouth in the Ivy League.
Louise, what about that? Are the students at Dartmouth fighting for something a bit different than students elsewhere?
Dartmouth is just such an interesting case because they're Ivy League players. They don't get scholarships. The fact that they don't get scholarships was one of the things that bugged them enough to get together and talk about ways they could change their working conditions. But in some ways, the idea that they are not being paid for what they're doing, but they are being arguably disciplined, their working conditions are controlled, their hours are set, they're performing each week, the fruits of their labor. I mean, the argument that people on the pro-union side are making are, these things are work. Not getting paid for them is not necessarily a mitigating factor. It's an aggravating factor.
At the top level, it seems like this is not just about money. Could what we see here more broadly across university athletics kind of be about that, about students just trying to improve conditions?
That's absolutely an argument that a lot of the pro-union players have put forward. They want things like healthcare coverage to be different. They want things like the right to bargain their hours of practice. They don't necessarily want to practice any less. In fact, they would all argue that they might want to practice more. But they want to at least be able to sit down at the table and discuss it. And what they have been told, and what 13 out of 15 of the Dartmouth players clearly believed, is that they will not be able to have that seat at the table unless it is given to them formally with the recognition of a union.
And just in our final moment here for both of you, is something changing when professionalization of college athletics begins to become a theme? Does it change universities in some more profound way? Does it change how we envision sports in our society?
Oh, it's changed radically. These decisions are being made for money, pure and simple. And that is an incredible shift in the way that college athletics has operated, where they used to sort of at least pretend that they were under some sort of different kind of umbrella of amateurism and tradition and the way things once were. But that is absolutely out the window at this point.
One of the really interesting things is that public opinion has finally tilted. Last couple of years, for the first time, a majority of respondents in the Seton Hall poll have said that they favor athletes being compensated for their performance on the field for the first time. And that number is really sort of ticked steadily in this direction. But at this point, among self-identified sports fans, 62% of them want to see financial compensation for athletes, at least in revenue-producing sports. We're also clearly going to see a big difference in how we refer to sports, all the sports that occur on a college campus. Revenue-producing is a pretty loaded term. It's a term used in this particular poll. But, you know, what it means to have a women's gymnastics team, why you're doing it, what you're trying to get out of it.
I've been joined today by Wall Street Journal sports reporter Louise Radnofsky and Journal sports columnist Jason Gay. I have a feeling we're going to have both of you on to talk about developments in this space very soon. Jason, Louise, thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it for What's New Sunday for April 7th. Today's show was produced by Charlotte Gartenberg with supervising producer Sandra Kilhoff. And we had help from deputy editors Scott Salloway and Chris Sinsley. I'm Luke Vargas, and we'll be back tomorrow morning with a new show. Until then, thanks for listening.